Right, hello everyone. Welcome back to the My Game Assembly interview podcast. I'm Mr. My Game, otherwise known as Matt Bambridge. And today we're here to do a kind of deep dive into Kingdom of Seasons, which was the recent fantasy My Game run by True North Mega Games up in Glasgow. And today I've got Seamus with me. Say hi, Seamus.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Brilliant. Most welcome. And we've got Niece returning as well. Say hello, Niece.
Hello, Niece.
Right, okay. So kind of like last time, we're going to go through a series of questions, and we're going to start with Seamus. We're going to forego Niece because you already know who Niece is and how Niece got into mega gaming. So Seamus, how did you get into mega gaming? What's your kind of gaming background? Tell us a bit about True North.
Sure, absolutely. So I've been mega gaming since the ancient days of 2016. Which makes me a relative newcomer to the sort of community of mega gaming. My first game was Dungeons of Yendor, the Pennine Mega Games run of Dungeons of Yendor. And I found out about mega gaming, as many people did, by watching a certain Shut Up and Sit Down series of videos, which I watched, and I knew instantly that I would fall in love with the hobby, and I in fact did. So for several years, for the first few years of my involvement with the hobby, it was pretty much just heading down to Pennine's games, where my local mega gaming network, in many respects, apart from a couple which were being run in Dundee. So last year, a few of us decided that we would start a new mega gaming network running out of Carlisle, Glasgow, Newcastle and Dundee, just for this year so far, and we'll see if we expand a little further in future years. But a mega gaming network for the very northern parts of Great Britain, and running a variety of inclusive games, and that's True North, and that's the network that Kingdom of Seasons was run by.
Excellent. Yeah, it's really exciting to see another my game group kind of pop up, especially kind of doing the north of the Pennines. I imagine it must have been slightly frustrating for your local group to be a couple of hundred miles down south.
Well, yeah, I mean, as I said, we had Kieran in Dundee doing sterling work with his games. But, you know, obviously he was just one person in one city, and you know, generally running only one game a year. So if we wanted more than one game a year, and I can't imagine anyone wanting to play more than one mega game a year, Matthew.
No comment on that.
Absolutely. Then we would have to travel down to Leeds and Manchester usually. So we wanted some mega games in our own back garden rather than quite so far away.
Yeah, that's right. I'm aware I'm quite lucky, as all the people down in London are, that there are quite a few games down here being served by kind of London and John Miser now in the southwest. So it's really good that you're expanding the places where people can play games.
Absolutely.
Okie dokie. So we'll crack on into the game then. So you designed the game, obviously, Seamus, but Niece, why don't you give us a little kind of 30-second intro on what you were playing, so people know kind of what perspective you've got on the game.
Okay. So it was a few months ago now, I think, that Seamus messaged me and said, "How would you feel about playing a god?" And I mean, what can I say? Yes, I want to play a god. So I was playing the Goddess of Summer, and my goals were few and simple, but we'll get into that in a bit, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Okie dokie. So why don't you start us off with the theming, Seamus? That, after all, is what kind of hooks people into going to a games, because they won't really know anything about the mechanics when the game flashes up to them. So take us through the theming.
Sure, absolutely. So I knew right from minute one that I wanted the mega game to be a true high fantasy romp. I think mega games, the sort of mega gaming community, is very well served with science fiction mega games and sort of near future dystopian mega games, and with historical mega games, particularly 20th century mega games. But there aren't that many high fantasy or games which are of a high fantasy genre. And, you know, I mean, I love high fantasy. I love the swords and sorcery. I love that kind of dragons and Lord of the Rings. And I mean, indeed, it was the book Lord of the Rings was the first piece of art ever to cause little Seamus to have an emotional reaction to a piece of art, you know. And
which piece of art was that?
Well, it was Lord of the Rings I'm talking about here. You know, that moment. I mean, spoiler alert if you haven't read Lord of the Rings. But at some point, the wizard Gandalf on the bridge of Khazad-dûm ends up falling to what little baby Seamus thought was his death. And, you know, I ended up tossing my copy of Lord of the Rings from one side of my bedroom to the other and falling asleep in a huff. And that was the first time that a piece of art had caused an emotional response from little baby Seamus. And, you know, that sort of thing leaves a mark. So I knew I wanted to run something in the high fantasy genre. On the sort of initial marketing sort of materials, I sort of compared the game to books like Lord of the Rings or Wizard of Earthsea, Chronicles of Narnia. But as the game approached, and certainly having seen the game now played, I think, and perhaps Niece can perhaps can comment on this, I think it's actually more accurate to say that the game is based on the more kind of trashy, pulpy B-movies that we all grew up with, your Willow and your Neverending Story and your Dark Crystal, and these kind of rompish, you know, swords and sorcery movies that were so much fun during our youth. And I think that's really where the game gets its magic from.
Yeah, I will hear nothing said against Willow or Dark Crystal or any of those wonderful sword and sorcery tales that I especially loved.
Absolutely.
When I was growing up, I was a great fan of things like David Gemmell, sure. Which are very much a little bit on the grittier side of that high fantasy, but very, I got those vibes at various moments when I was playing the game.
Absolutely, and I think especially in terms of villains, you know, I love Game of Thrones, I love series like The Name of the Wind and you know, the Mistborn series quite recently, you know. And these modern books are modern books and movies and TV shows are tremendous. But I am nostalgic for those classic 80s fantasy villains. You know, your Queen Bab Morda or your Skeksis from these movies. These kind of just moustache twirlingly caricature true pulp villains that I think all of us secretly really enjoy and really enjoy both their nefarious schemes but also their final triumphant defeat. You know, there's that wonderful arc that that I think we do sometimes miss out on the more modern gritty fantasy stories.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. And I always found things like the Evil Witch from when I was stuff, they were still incredibly frightening and deadly. And the Conan, obviously, the bad guy there is, again, they're hilariously over the top.
Absolutely.
But there is also just this sense of cold hard, I am going to kill you.
Yeah.
In the end. And obviously, Cersei, she's never quite as over the top. She's just cold and deadly. And that does, it's a very different experience. I'll agree with that.
Sure.
Yeah, okie dokie. So that's the theming then. Do you want to give us a quick brush over where you got the inspiration for mechanics from? We're going to go into a bit of a deeper dive on kind of various little bits of mechanics in a bit, but is there any particular thing that you drew from for mechanics?
To be honest, I wanted, especially for my first mega game, I didn't want to try and break the mold. You know, I think both of you would probably agree that in many respects it was quite a classic megagame in the sense that there was a map, there were factions, there were armies, there was a bit of diplomacy, a bit of trading. You know, it wasn't some grand new let's push the envelope. And that's fine. You know, that was what I was aiming for. I think some of the faction rules were perhaps a little bit more interesting because it wouldn't be a high fantasy game, I think, without individual faction nuance. But as far as the main game is concerned, I think by and large it was fairly instantly recognizable to anyone that's played two or three other mega games, I would think. Probably the ones that I drew the most inspiration for from probably would be Shot Heard Around the Universe by Tim, or of course the Everybody Dies series of games by Becky. I think those are the two that I drew the most inspiration from, I'd say.
Yeah, okay. I mean, yeah, there are definitely traditional elements there, but the way you did resources was quite different, and the character sheets you had were quite different as well. And we'll cover those a bit more when we go into a bit more of a mechanics dive. Okie dokie. So a couple of things I know you wanted to go into a little bit was kind of marketing and art for Kingdom and Seasons. I've got to say, the art was absolutely brilliant for the game.
You know, I think when you're running something like, I think more so than any other genre, I think high fantasy benefits from a very clear and defined art style, and very, you know, I think it helps people to really place themselves in the world and in this landscape that you're conjuring from your mind, just straight out of my imagination, I suppose. More so, I think, even than a science fiction world, you know? So right from the get-go, I knew I needed, you know, rather than just telling people, so we have these human-sized penguins dressed as Ottomans who come from the South Pole, I knew I needed that to get someone to actually draw these characters so that people could really see what the hell I was talking about. So I engaged, over the course of the entire project, I engaged three very talented artists, Kanna Klaus and Sarah Burt and Jenny Spears, over the course of the game. And we worked together for more than a year, actually, particularly with Kanna Clausen, who was the main artist for the game, to really develop, I think, quite an inviting, but also quite an emotive visual style for the game. Something that would conjure up so that people would understand that this is not some gritty, realist, dark and dingy fantasy, nor is it a true sort of comedy fantasy in the vein of Terry Pratchett. It's somewhere in the middle, and it's somewhere that your imagination can really just let you go bonkers, really go bananas, and just take your own adventure on whatever path you see fit, you know. And I think that really helped players to sort of get themselves ready to situate themselves in the world, so that their schemes and their plans and their plots could really feel natural to that particular fantasy landscape.
Do you think that's missing from a lot of other games? I mean, obviously the historical style games and the kind of 20th century military games, they tend to have a wide variety of just like free material they can grab from the internet, tanks and soldiers and all that type of stuff. Do you think it's something that's lacking from the other fantasy and sci-fi and kind of cyberpunk games out there?
I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, to be honest, as I said, I think it is most necessary for some reason. Perhaps I'm unusual here, but I do think it is most useful for unusual, most needed. Sorry, most needed for fantasy style games. You know, when you point to even a game, so something like Watch the Skies. You know, the sort of the great classics of mega gaming. No matter what time period you set that game, whether it be near future, near past, etc., the inclusion of aliens, I don't think really necessitates a grand backstory, a visual backstory, or a visual retelling of the world. People kind of understand, I think, or can much more quickly acclimatize themselves to whatever mythology the designers are cooking up. And even with science fiction, I personally I'm much more comfortable walking into a science fiction mega game with my own visual idea as to what the spaceships and the factions and the planets and so on might look like, than perhaps I would be walking into an original IP or a semi-original IP fantasy game like Kingdom of Seasons. But maybe that's just me being unusual.
Yeah, it's interesting. Nice. What do you think about art in mega games, and whether more needed for fantasy games and other style games?
Okay. I think for me, I get a lot of my mental imagery from reading. So actually I found that the written materials that you produced, Seamus, for the game were more evocative for me than the artwork, although I really did appreciate the artwork. And I think that it's definitely something that brings some extra flavor going into a game.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. The one thing I obviously would add to that is that there is obviously an added cost, financial cost, I mean, to producing original or having someone produce original artwork. Matthew?
Yeah, that's going to be my follow-up question, actually, about obviously you don't have to go into an exact cost, but what kind of impact did that have on your budget?
So, yeah, so in terms of budget, I knew that, I mean, obviously, any artist I commissioned to do work for the game, I would obviously, you know, it would go without saying that I would pay them a fair price for their work. You know, none of this exposure, paying you an exposure bollocks. You know, obviously they would get a fair price for it. And that was obviously a negotiation between the various artists and myself. And it was something that I was very, very mindful of going in. And it's not necessarily something I would do with every game that I might hypothetically do go towards. But I do think that particularly for a first game, and this is the thing, I mean, you know, this is obviously my first game. If it had been a disaster, I don't think it was, but if it had been a disaster, a total catastrophe, it would definitely have been my last game. So I wanted to a certain extent, really, you know, enter the room in style, if that makes sense. I wasn't going to hold back on any particular element of it. So for me, although it did obviously push up the price, and it did obviously, you know, impact in terms of financial recompense from running the game, ultimately it was something that I wanted to do for my enjoyment of creating the game. It was something that I wanted to add in more, I mean, obviously for the players as well, to help them situate themselves. But to be honest, I just wanted some nice artwork for this world that I was creating, for my own personal journey as a designer going through this world. And actually, on that, there are several parts of the game which were either directly or indirectly influenced by suggestions and questions that the artists themselves would ask me. You know, so when I was particularly when it came to religion, particularly when it came to institutions like the Royal College, they would ask me questions about iconography, about belief system, about all sorts of things which I hadn't even really occurred to me. But then from that, things like the Royal College Library, which was one of the more fun mechanics, entirely grew out of a conversation I had with Kanna Clausen when we were discussing her drawing appropriate artwork for the Royal College, you know, and that creative process, you know, engaging with these other creative people was actually enormously rich and enormously beneficial for me, seeing sides to this world, seeing sides to this game through their perspective on what this world was, you know, on what this world was. That benefited me enormously, I think. And it built so much more richness and so many more layers into the game than I myself alone could have given it. And that was wonderful.
Yeah, that's interesting. So kind of engaging more people in that creative process from that side kind of led to more ideas for the game.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so we'll finish off this kind of sanctuary. I know you wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking about kind of how gender influenced your casting for Kingdom of Seasons.
Well, sure. I mean, and this is something I've sort of learned a lot from a variety of different people over my time playing Mega Games. And, you know, there's been this, from what I understand, there's been this very concerted effort by a lot of people within the community, Becky in particular and Tim and various other people. There's been this really deliberate, a lot of hard work has gone in, I believe, over the past decade and perhaps even two decades in addressing the gender imbalance, which we continue to find in a lot of mega games which are run in the UK. And from my perspective, running my first mega game, designing my first mega game, I took the attitude that it just wasn't enough, particularly as a heteronormative male designer. It wasn't enough for me to simply say, oh, well, I'm not sexist, so my game's not going to be sexist. I don't think that's enough. I don't think that's the way change happens. So I was very determined right from minute one of the design process that a lot of the most, I don't want to necessarily say powerful, but certainly a lot of the most influential, the characters who I suspected might really shape some of the core moments in the game, I knew I wanted to cast them to female or non-binary players right from the get-go. So five of the main characters right at the beginning of the game are obviously the two goddesses who were female from minute one of the design document. Plus, within some of the mortal realms, we had one character who has the most direct path, as it were, within the game to becoming the empress of the human empire, along with two of her most significant adversaries, the so-called Midnight Queen, who was the principal vampire queen, vampire lady, whatever, within the game, and the three members of the sort of Frost Witch coven among the barbaric northern clans. All these characters I knew pretty much from minute one I wanted to cast with female or non-binary players. And you know, obviously this is just a small drop in the ocean, but I do think the more this happens in games, the more that we build roles deliberately addressing this elephant in the room, which is the continued gender imbalance within nerd culture more generally, within society more generally, but certainly within megagaming, the more progress, slow and steady and gradual progress that we're going to make towards addressing that balance.
Yeah, and I agree with all of that, essentially. And there has been a slow climb to more female and non-binary attendance over the last couple of years, but it is absolutely safe to say that we've got a long way to kind of go for that. Nice, I apologize if this is a terrible question, as you're the female on the podcast. In terms of things that are more likely to get you to come to Mega Games, and obviously you're a single individual, you're not representative of everyone who's female or non-binary out there. Are these kind of things enough, or do we need to be doing more? Is it a matter of publicizing more straight away, or can we rely on kind of Mega Game reports and photographs to kind of show people in these roles?
That is an enormous question. Sure. And obviously...
yes, it is. And I will encourage you to keep it down to 2 or 3 minutes, just because we've got a lot to go through. Although, obviously, in the future, we're planning to do a much larger podcast than this, because it is something that the Mega Game community needs to work on if we're going to grow the hobby.
Yeah, and I think I'd rather reserve a lot of kind of the answer to that question for that podcast, actually, because I think it's worth spending a lot more time on. I think for me personally, attending Mega Games on my own as a woman, I like to see pictures of previous Mega Games featuring other women. That gives me confidence that I won't just be the single woman in the room. As far as that goes, I think we are making progress. There are more women playing regularly, but it would be just fabulous to see more women and non-binary folk at games and really getting stuck in and being in charge of stuff and, oh, I don't know, burning the world.
Possibly not so much with burning the world.
I don't know, actually, just to sort of follow on from that, going back to the discussion we had just a moment ago about the artwork for the game, something which I hope came across from the very beginning was we really wanted to have a variety of different people and different genders, different body types, even just all sorts of different people represented within the artwork for the game, people of color, and we really wanted to sort of portray a diverse and inclusive fantasy world as much as possible. And I think within that artwork, I think we actually did manage. And we ended up with actually a pretty good gender balance in terms of the players on the day. And that was, I think, wonderful. That was really good.
I think that was great.
Yeah, certainly one of the games that I think where I've seen the most kind of people on non-binary players, which is really great. Okay, moving slightly on then, we're going to go through the factions. Now, there are quite a few of the factions, so we probably won't spend more than 2 or 3 minutes on them. But what I really want to do in kind of these interview podcasts is for someone who has the opportunity to play the game in the future or kind of wants to know more about what happened in the game, to kind of give them an overview of what factions were there and kind of what they did. So while not a faction, possibly, as they were a central focus of the game, do you want to kick off with the gods, Seamus?
Well, it's funny that you want to kick off with the gods because, and I think Nice would probably agree with this, is that I think the gods game is the part of the game which worked the least well, I would say. I would say that the gods game is probably the only core part of the game that I would tear up almost completely and start from scratch. And the main problem with the gods game was that it worked almost exactly as I had intended it to. And as it turned out, that wasn't the most fun it could be, I think, for the players, for the two players who were in these roles. What the gods game was intended to represent was that classic fantasy trope where the divine being of extraordinary power manifests for a few moments in the character's story and changes the fates of the world. And I think that's exactly what happened. You know, whether or not the players who are playing the gods necessarily realized it, Nice, you can perhaps comment on this in a moment. But the moments when they did directly influence the flow of the game had enormous impact upon the rest of the mortal players. I think the issue is that with your standard fantasy novel, your standard fantasy movie, these beings of supreme power pop up for a few pages and then vanish for several chapters, only to reappear to reward the heroes and heroines with some kind of bounty. But the problem is that when you have actual players in these positions, there's not that much for them to be getting on with, to be doing, to be engaged with the world in that intervening space between their moments of incredible, like manifesting their incredible powers. And I think what I will need to work on, and ideally with Nice and Sarah's, who is Winter, Nice and Sarah's help, is building a better gods game, which allows players, on the one hand, to still do those incredible moments of incredible, you know, power, which dramatically shifts the game state for all players, but also in the kind of in the off season, as it were, to have a fun and engaging and enthralling and challenging game as well. Nice, would you say that's fair?
I would overall, yeah. I think there was quite a lot of downtime involved. I mean, and I used that primarily to stare at players and intimidate them from the stage, which was a lot of fun. but I would say there was a lot of downtime, particularly when one of us had manifested and one of us was left alone on the stage. There wasn't a lot to be getting on with. Certainly in my role as God, I hadn't bothered to learn any of the mortal players kind of clan names or anything. I didn't know who any of them were. It didn't really matter to me. If they weren't worshipping me, they weren't worth my time. And it's interesting that you say that our kind of actions had a big effect on the mortal game, because I really just felt like I was kind of poking them every now and again, and then I didn't really see a lot of the impact of that. I guess that kind of fits in with, I felt it was very much beneath me. I think that part of the game was executed really well, because I genuinely, as a god, just felt like they were little ants and they were doing their thing, and then sometimes they'd come and worship me, and that was nice.
That's definitely how it felt from the point of view of being immortal for half the game, gods were largely inscrutable and standing up on the stage doing stuff, basically. So that's very much how it felt from down on the floor.
Yeah, just to sort of explain the layout of the room, and this worked really well with the venue we had. It was in a venue which is normally used for gigs and DJs and this sort of thing. So we had at one end of the room, we had a bar, which is what we were using as a kind of control player bunker. And then the main floor, we would have our sort of maps and our main team spaces for the mortal players. And then on the stage, we had what we were calling the heavens. And this is where at the start of the game, the two goddesses were trapped, trapped by the creator within the sort of mythology of the game. And the only mortal players who were allowed to access the stage were priests and clerics and those characters within this world who had built over, you know, several decades, had built a relationship with the divine. So there was quite a stark divide, and it worked. It looked wonderful. We had these two, and with amazing costumes, by the way, just some spectacular costumes, particularly from our goddesses, sitting directly above, literally above the mortal plane, looking down upon them. And that, you know, that was perfect. I just don't think it was necessarily, I just don't think there was quite enough feedback going back into the heavens from the mortal plane to really sort of tide over the goddesses between big moments.
And have you got any idea on any quick fixes for that, while still preserving the kind of core integrity you want there, where they do turn up occasionally and change the game state? Because that, as a mortal, was really nice. But obviously, I think, as we said before, and I'm a big believer in, players shouldn't be forced to have a slightly off game in parts, because it's good for the game in a whole. Everyone should be turning up and having a reasonable expectation they're going to be consistently busy and getting the same kind of volume of experience.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes, indeed. And I am, you know, I don't think I'm the right person necessarily to sort of make those changes. I'm actually keen to hear in due time, once they've had time to reflect with each other, both from Sarah and from Nice, about what their thoughts might be to improve the game. My initial sort of, in the immediate aftermath of the game, my only real thought would be to discard parts of the game, such as tracking. We had a single track tracking global temperature, and obviously summer is trying to heat the world up and winter is trying to cool the world down. And we had a progression of seasons, summer to autumn to winter and so on. But these systems were largely detached, unfortunately. They were largely detached from other game states and other game and the other game systems. They were largely absent from that, and I think better integrating these systems, global temperature, weather, just the progression of the seasons themselves, and making that a real concern, a much greater and much deeper concern for the mortal players, rather than just a sort of these elements of the game were more of a kind of a mild inconvenience, occasional mild inconvenience. I think better integrating them into the sort of regular play of the mortals, I think, would be quite beneficial to the game overall, but particularly to the gods game.
So yeah, kind of moving on from the gods then, we've got a bunch of other factions here. So could you kind of walk us through how those interact with each other, the odd line here and there, kind of what their inspiration is?
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. So one of the sort of systems and the sort of synergies which I was really hoping would kick off, and indeed really did land on the day, was between the sort of main standard fantasy human kingdoms, which dominated the sort of central map and the central play area, and indeed were the largest total number of players on the day, with the main mercantile factions in the game. So we had this very large group of players representing various human kingdoms who all had their kind of steady, regular income from farms and mines and so on. But to really get stuff done, they would need to interact quite extensively with the world of finance, as it were, the world of commerce. It was built into the rules from the beginning that your average medieval noble simply cannot transport hundreds of tons of grain or iron or whatever from one side of the kingdom to another. They needed help from some of the other factions. And the two main factions within this were the Pengali, who were the sort of anthropomorphic penguin trading faction, and the dwarves, who had their own smaller trading network, but also access to what we call these rune forges, for them to build custom-made artifacts. And this ended up working really quite well, because all of these trading factions had access to what we called the market, which allowed them to buy armor and equipment and companions and mounts and all sorts of fun things, all your fantasy staples. And your average player could, if they wanted to, try and negotiate with these merchants, try and buy the exact piece of equipment or near enough type of equipment that they were looking for. And maybe it was available, maybe it wasn't, maybe they could afford it, maybe they couldn't. Or they could go directly to the dwarves and they could have custom made exactly the type of equipment or mount or companion or even military units that they were looking for, but at a much, much greater price. And this really worked well because players were therefore constantly torn between maybe getting a slightly less useful object at a much cheaper price, or spending a great deal more money and getting exactly what they were looking for from the dwarves. And this sort of back and forward and this economy actually worked. I mean, as far as I could tell, as far as the players seemed to be engaging with it, a lot of money was changing hands back and forward between all the different players. A lot of goods and services were changing hands back and forward. And real deals and real negotiations were happening amongst all sorts of factions. And I think that really worked. You know, I think that really worked. Another synergy that I was really pleased with was between two of the other factions. The close neighbors and the long-term enemies of the dwarves are, of course, everyone's favorite greenskins, the orc hordes. And their game was quite separate to most players. Their economy was almost entirely driven by conflict. They didn't really have resource buildings in the same way that other factions did. They really only could expand by battling either each other or other factions. They were certainly the most warlike of all the factions. But one of the sort of systems that I threw in almost as an afterthought, very, very late in the design process, was the ability for them to become mercenary armies for other factions. And I added into this a system where the armies, because it's fantasy and because it's magic and because magic can do anything, I added in a system whereby each greenskin army could sign a contract with one other player faction that could then teleport to exactly the right moment. They could be on speed dial effectively and get FedExed from one side of the game to the other to fight whatever battle was needed, and then they would immediately teleport back to where they were going. And this ended up working far better than I was expected, because they were constantly employed by one of the northern factions, the Kasai Daimyo, who had a very small but very elite group of units, but right from turn one were constantly threatened by some of the other northern factions, the northern barbarian factions, the clans, the snow clans, who had a larger number of slightly weaker units. But right from the get-go, the Kasai always had at least, I believe, two orc hordes on speed dial, constantly throwing these greenskins into the meat grinder that was their northern border, which allowed them just to have that enough wiggle room to begin to build up their own economy and to fulfill their own objectives. And these kind of factional synergies, these different factions using their own mechanics with each other for mutual benefit, that was just brilliant. That was really wonderful to see The player is just taking these mechanics and really making them work for them, making them valuable to them. I think that did work really well.
Yeah, I suppose there are a couple of things to pull out there. So I'll do the economy first. So the economy game in so many games just doesn't always kind of work all that well, unfortunately. So there are a couple of things that seem to make yours work really well, which was the two different traders doing slightly different things, and the way people got resources was really well found, and hats off to Jerry, Carolina, and Kenny. Sorry. So they were behind the bar, and basically you had a series of items on your character sheet, and they would generate that for the beginning of each turn. And so going to get those resources was really quite smooth. I think probably smoother than in most games I've played, to be honest. It was it was really quite impressive.
So one of my main bugbears, to keep with the fantasy theme, one of my main bugbears, or owlbears, I suppose I should say, with some mega games is the poor old control player, whichever the poor old control player is, that is tasked at the beginning of each turn to run around the room and try and find every player and hand them a handful of tokens and resources, you know? Because I just don't think it's efficient. I don't think it's a good use of control time. And I think it's frustrating to players if they happen to be the team which is furthest away from wherever the controller based. No, with my game, we made use of the geography of the room. And we had a bar laid out, and each player knew exactly. So boring, well, not so much boring, but similar to those of you who perhaps play Trope High with the school locker system. Each individual player had an individual little box, and they would know that at the beginning of each turn, within the resource gathering phase, they could go up to that box, pick up the resources that they were due, and walk away. And that was it. And yes, it really did seem to work, apart from the first couple of turns where we had a few teething problems. But once Carolina and Kenny and Jerry had sort of got those ironed out, and they were entirely my fault for my own naivety, but once they had got those ironed out, yeah, players just knew to dash over to the bar, grab their resources, then back to the map, ready to make their moves if they were going to do that. And yeah, it worked.
Yeah, that dash for resources was particularly terrifying for me, as I was holding a lot of corruption every turn. But corruption is a mechanic that we will talk about in a little bit. Sure. So I just kind of want to pull out of the factions one I don't think we talked about much there, the Royal College. And
right.
The Royal College's role was, because all the other factions, I think, while they've got their kind of particular spice to them, the orcs being mercenaries, the Northern Wild being kind of those Northern Barbarians, as you said, you've got Imperial Slayer, who are the kind of big human faction. The High Church of Seasons and the Royal College, for two of them, were quite different. So do you want to take us through those?
Sure, absolutely. So unlike the other factions, where the religious element of their faction was integrated more explicitly within the team structure, what I wanted to do with the main imperial, the sort of human empire faction, which was to break them up as much as possible. I wanted each individual player, although they were aligned to a particular kingdom and ultimately to the empire overall, I did want them to be pursuing their own, often quite divergent objectives, each individually. Some of them had secret societies, some of them were in political parties, and so on and so forth. And so to make that work and to really make that land, we needed to have separate factional power structures for the main religious body of the empire, which was the Church of Seasons, and I suppose the main scientific body of the empire, which was the Royal College. Both of these teams had only what what we called theist players, players that could directly access the heavens, could directly negotiate with the gods. But they lacked any kind of mobile military force. They couldn't command armies around the map. So in sort of classic D&D sense, they were your mages and your clerics, your more support classes. But within a sort of within a grand strategy game, within a top-down political game, they ended up in, I think, being both the glue that ended up holding certain alliances within the empire together, and also the grit and spice in those particular wheels that made things fall apart. And that was exactly what they were intended to be. More than that, particularly when we look at the Royal College, they had access to all sorts of little fun extras, I think we would describe them, little bonus things that weren't integral to the game, but I think added quite a lot of spice to it. For one thing, and a lot of players did make use of this, they had the Royal College Library, which was a ring binder stuffed full of random documents that either I had written or I had downloaded off the internet, and indeed the rule book for the entire game, which I thought was quite handy, but contained hidden within this sort of giant ring binder full of nonsense, mainly hidden within that were most of the secrets of the game. So if players, and some players did, if some players were clever and were observant and could draw connections together, they could actually get a pretty good sense of what some of the other players' secrets might be, what some of the other players might be hiding, and thus use that to their advantage. And that was, I think that was a lot of fun for some players who were really into that sort of thing, solving puzzles.
Lisa, the High Church of Seasons is one of the gods. You interacted with them quite a bit, didn't you?
Yeah, that was interesting because, initially at the start of the game, obviously we started in spring, which was lovely, and then it got warmer and it got into summer, and everyone started, I think, a little bit to panic that I was warming things up in an unnatural way, and actually it was just the natural passing of the seasons. So a lot of the attention initially was on my beautiful sister Winter, because they were all very concerned that she should be able to cool the world down again because I must be getting out of hand. So I got a little bit sulky at the beginning, in character, of course, and was maybe increasingly petulant with the priests as they came to visit Winter.
Okay. So I think that's the kind of the interconnectivity of the faction. So we'll kind of dive into mechanics a bit. I suppose two ones to start off with, because they seem to correlate quite a lot with each other, was faith and corruption. So faith was what players were generating to give to the gods, and corruption was this not particularly well understood thing that would go into people's character sheets and fill up some of their slots, but they could also spend it on various dark magics and dark units. And I must admit, I spent quite a lot of time on corruption.
You actually spent more time than I was expecting anyone to be honest. Weirdly enough, most of the players who were kind of briefed to engage with the corruption, the vampires, the necromancers, and the demon worshippers, barely touched it in comparison to you.
I was starting the day off, and my brief kind of seemed a little bit Voldemort-y, and
he's lying. He's absolutely lying. His brief was Joffrey. It was 100% Joffrey. He was just Joffrey without any power. Don't listen to him, folks. He's a total liar.
I will absolutely refute that to the core of my being, kids. I looked at my brief and kind of went, right, what have we got here? And I was looking through it, obviously. And one of the things on there is people should respect my great bloodline, and I should be trying to seize power. And I was a member of a secret cult. I might not have been aiming for Voldemort, Seamus, but you wrote Voldemort.
Fair enough. Joffrey, but as Voldemort. We'll compromise.
Fair enough.
Either way, very untrustworthy.
I was lovely. I was... So my game started off with that, and I was a member of one of the cults, which we'll cover in just a second, trying to let Summer out. And I was doing this by interacting quite heavily with this thing called corruption. Before I go off on the corruption story, Seamus, do you want to kind of tell us what faith and corruption were?
Certainly, absolutely. So within the game, there were effectively two economic systems, one of which was pretending to be a religious system. The players would, as you said, they would generate among the resources they would just generate. One of the things they would generate was faith, and this was represented by standard player cards, and these cards were absolutely useless to most players, except. In their interactions with the gods. And of course, as most players could not directly interact with the gods, they would have to trade them with religious players, your wizards and your clerics, who would then take them to the heavens and exchange them for magic, primarily for magic. The gods control the only source of magic within the game. But on the flip side, every interaction with a god or a goddess, as the case may be, we keep saying gods, I think because it's shorter, but they were goddesses. But anyway, each interaction with a goddess would basically just burn a small hole within a mortal's mind. And this was represented by just blank, black bits of paper, which were obliged to be affixed to your character sheet, clogging up different resource squares and different item squares, places in your inventory. And if you collected too many items of corruption, too many corruption cards, your character would either start doing weird things as dictated by control, or they would simply die, and you would lose all your experience, you would lose all your resources, you would be pretty significant. So managing these two divine resources, faith and corruption, was a relatively significant part of people's day. It was nowhere near as significant, and this goes back to what I was saying about redoing the gods game from scratch. It wasn't as significant as I think it should have been, or as it was intended to be, if that makes sense.
Yes, I was drawing quite a lot of faith cards as well as corruption, and I would occasionally pass those on to a player to take up to Summer. The corruption, it led to quite a bit of personal terror for me, because I started off the game generating one corruption a turn, and I would then get corruption from the people. So I spotted quite early on for me that there were good units and magic items you could get on what was the corruption marketplace, which was kind of the opposite of what Seamus was talking about earlier with the normal marketplace. So I was determined to do this. And Jonty made me a skull throne, which was great and not at all evil, before anyone says throw me the skulls.
Something which you may not have realized, Matthew, but the skull throne was the only building that both the civilized factions and the barbarian factions. It was the only item. It was the only building which had the same name and the same effect for both. Because my thinking is that a skull throne is a skull throne no matter where it's built. You know, it really lights up a whole room. I think a little gauche, perhaps, but nonetheless, I think the message you're sending when you build a skull throne is going to be the same whether you're a northern barbarian or whether you're a civilized lord. And you know, it's hard to accessorize a room which contains one. Is what I was getting at, you know?
Yeah, I particularly enjoyed having the skull throne sandwiched in between my church and my grand cathedral, which was great. But yeah, my moments of personal terror came when I was going to get my resources. I would have 9 corruptions, so one away from basically blowing my head off. And then would scamper as quickly as I could over to the dark marketplace to spend and get rid of it, because I was terrified of one of the goddesses intercepting me and saying hi and accidentally exploding me with corruption.
Were there any moments where that almost happened?
I managed to avoid it quite a lot, to be honest, because you were both on the stage and weren't intending to come down immediately as resources were called. So that kind of worked out for me. But there were a couple of moments of personal terror there. And then I got sacrificed and became a demon, and then I just had all of the corruption, as much corruption as I could possibly manage. So that was... okay, so in terms of, should we take a little bit of a brief look about kind of resources and buildings? Because we've talked about them kind of adjacently as we're going through. But I believe the resources were gold, a magic resource, food and supplies?
Supplies, yes, indeed. Yeah, in sort of the earlier drafts of the game, to be honest, I think that was perhaps... Along with faith and corruption, it was maybe too many different types of resources, perhaps, to manage. But actually, in an earlier draft of the game, I actually divided supplies between lumber and iron ore to really sort of bring that out. But yeah, I think it worked fine, but I think I was a little lucky there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I would say they worked fine, because with the faith and corruption... They weren't a part of a lot of players' days unless you chose to make
sure,
them part
yeah,
of their
sure.
Days. Faith was something you could go and get if you were very interested in playing that game with the gods and powering them up. And corruption, as we kind of covered, wasn't, apart from a couple of players, people were not going mad with corruption. And to be honest, that was for the benefit of myself and Chris Chester was going after corruption, because we were just drawing corruption out of the entire room because no one else was really interested in it. And so we would, people, frequency, they would just come past and go, do you still want some corruption? And as the day went on, then they would just go past and just give me corruption without saying anything. And I would, on my merry way, I would go with my corruption. I suppose on that, it felt like corruption was supposed to be a bigger part of the day than it was.
Yeah, perhaps. I think perhaps I need to have more ways when I say ordinary players, players that aren't actively seeking it, I think I need to have more ways for them to get tangled in that particular web, you know? It's a resource which was intended to be incredibly valuable to characters who practice the dark arts, vampires, necromancers, demons, etc., but was meant to be something which was... initially more of an annoyance, but then as the day went on, something more of a real threat to the sort of stability. A bit of a, not exactly Call of Cthulhu, Necronomicon, Lovecraft kind of effect, but like certainly with a slight touch of that kind of neck of the woods. I don't think that ended up happening. And you know what? Part of the reason why that didn't happen is because of player creativity. There was yourself who embarked upon this mad demon, you know, metamorphosis. There was a first-time player, first-time megagamer, who abandoned her brief quite quickly and instead set up a black market corruption and evil item network. She became this mafia lord or mafia lady of corruption and cursed artifacts, which was fantastic. You know, I think in a way, player imagination and player creativity vastly exceeded what I had prepared for when it came to corruption, and that's fantastic. That's wonderful. That's a problem I don't really want to solve, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's not a problem. That's not really a problem, is it? Because it's what leads to more of those moments for people. Niece, have you got anything to chip in with there?
Yeah, just to hop backwards ever so slightly, just to corruption. In my role as a, you know, benevolent deity, and on one of my rounds, once I did get free of my prison and was able to manifest temporarily on the mortal plane. In one of my rounds through the room, I actually had a couple of mortals approached me and just said hi and then held out their hands for corruption, which I gave them as we interacted. And then they just turned around and tried to walk away, at which point I felt it was very necessary for me to firmly put my foot down and demand to know what the hell they thought they were doing, and then to, you know, turn around, come back and apologize, and, you know, maybe grovel a little bit as well, just to make sure that I didn't feel slighted. Because really, were you going to do that and then walk away from a god, leaving them feeling a bit used? Doesn't seem wise.
What do you mean? There's nothing wrong with that at all.
Well, you would say that.
Indeed, I would. But yeah, okay. So that's kind of faith and corruption and kind of an overview of the resources. So in terms of mechanics, the last kind of thing to go over then was kind of the army's personal combat and then secret societies. Do you want to take us very briefly through, Seamus, about what the inspiration was for kind of those things?
One of the things which a few people have commented on were the character sheets and the army sheets, which every player, except the gods, received at the start of the day. And my kind of general inspiration for these kind of elements was sort of a mixture of your classic D&D campaign mixed with Total War Warhammer. That was the kind of combination I was going for. Every player started with a character sheet, which listed their inventory, their experience quota, and spaces in the top half of the sheet where they could construct buildings, whether it be resource creation or buildings to further unit production. The second sheet most players were given was their army sheet, which listed, it's hard to describe verbally, but the top half of the sheet, as it were your mainline combat units. The bottom half of the sheet were your support units, which would add bonuses to your main line. And the intention was, and I think once players got the hang of it, this actually worked out pretty well, was rather than faffing around with different cards and, you know, in the moment, you would have your army effectively set up, pre-set up, lined to the way you'd want it. You would, if you were to engage with a battle with someone, you would walk up to an appropriate battle table, and then you would just place down your two armies and just kick off. You'd start noting down damage and attacks and things. And by and large, I think once players kind of got that, it actually sped things up, sped battles up quite quickly. And I wanted, from quite early on, I wanted battles to be quite beefy, to be quite meaningful. I didn't want it to be a short risk style affair where, you know, I have one handful of dice, you have one handful of dice, we both roll and then we, you know, one of us wins. No, because some of the factions, you know, the orcs, the northern barbarians, the clans, I knew that they would be spending a lot of their day engaging with battles. That was a large part of their entire game. I wanted it to be both tactically and strategically interesting. I wanted it to be a puzzle for players to try and unpick how best to deploy their forces, where to apply bonuses and magic spells and pieces of equipment and so on, and which battles to take against which opponents and which battles to retreat from. And I wanted this to be a sort of meaty and engaging and fun part of the day for the players who were going to be particularly using it.
Yeah, that's always good. I think that there's always a struggle in my games to try and go between combat that is interesting, combat that is quick. I will say it did have the traditional problem of people who engaged in combat all the way throughout the day did have the advantage because they were just more familiar with it. But I have no idea how to solve that eventually.
The thing is, you know, within the sort of game mythology, within the reality of the game, a commander who did spend their entire life fighting would simply be better at organizing their army than a commander who's fresh onto the field, onto their first battle. Now, that might not necessarily be. I'm not saying that's not frustrating for the new player, but it does kind of make sense mechanically within the game. So again, perhaps some tweaking, but I think fundamentally the system works okay in that sense.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay. And then the last one then is the secret society. So there was the
yes.
Order of the Phoenix that was trying to let summer out. There was a winter cult that was trying to let winter out. They were the vampires. I suppose the bit that I want to focus on most, because it seemed to go both right and wrong on the day was the bit around the secret society is trying to let Summer and Winter out.
Sure, absolutely. So I'd just say there were players drawn from various different factions who were both effectively competing for the same prize. And the idea was that they would solve various puzzles throughout the day, hidden. The first one, which ended up being far more complicated for players to solve than I had anticipated, was hidden in a piece of music. Some players had to decode some pieces of music. And they would then follow on to additional puzzles, and they would have to move to certain parts of the map, and they would have to do particular rituals and incantations. And ultimately, ideally, as a grand finale of the game, perhaps one of the goddesses would be freed from their prison and would sort of stomp around the map, and then the rest of the mortals would have to deal with that. And I think ultimately what we needed was perhaps one more control player who was explicitly tasked with this particular game. What happened fairly early on was that one of the factions, the Winter faction, got some semi-incorrect information from a control player. It wasn't their fault, you know. The control player in question was just answering as best they understood, but it led them to believe that because of the successes of the Summer faction, of your faction, Matthew, it led them to believe that there was no possible way for them to then complete their own ritual. Which wasn't the case, you know. The game was designed so that both sets of cultists could technically, both of them together, simultaneously, though separately, could both release their own deities. But because of various things, at the end of the day, we've all done mega games, because of the pandemonium and the chaos of the mega game, of the nature of a mega game, that information kind of got muddled and got sort of lost in the switch, and they ended up sort of partially abandoning their particular quest to release Winter. And I think that did sort of slightly unbalance some parts of the game. Now, but that was entirely my own naivety. That was entirely my inexperience as a game designer and as game control. Running it again, I think I would make it much more explicit to have a named control player apart from myself who was clued up on all the secrets, who knew all the rituals, who knew all the different stages of the game. And so if they noticed, because obviously, you know, the controller doing 1,000 things, if they noticed that one faction or another, one secret society or another, perhaps wasn't pursuing their objectives quite strongly enough, they would know to go up to the particular team and perhaps ask, you know, what's going on? Why aren't you doing this? Can I be of any help? You know, can I create some scenario where help can come across?
Yeah, and more control kind of bandwidth always kind of helps. So I think the solution to that one may be as simple as giving the two items two different names.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Because that was the source of confusion for that. Both of these items had the same name, and the Summer cultists kind of went and found it. And yeah, that did give the Winter cult the belief that they couldn't then find it. And functionally, there were two of them, and to be honest, they're the same thing that both factions can use, but possibly just a different name could have solved that one.
Sure.
But those are all things to kind of look out for a second run, Seamus. So yeah, okay. So I think that's a nice dive into the kind of factions, inspiration, art, the mechanics. So, well, on the highlights then, how do you think it went? What would any one thing you would change most of all? I know we've talked about the gods and some of the secret societies, but how do you think it went?
Well, yeah, I mean, the major thing I would change would be the gods game. In terms of any other things that I would change, basically, the one thing I would change is just my own inexperience. Because so many of the minor problems that happened throughout the day were basically just because of my own naivety, my own, like, just doing it for the first time, you know? And it's, you learn from experience. You learn from doing things. And if I were to run it again, Matthew Bainbridge, there are certain structural, certain behind the scenes is what I'm getting at. Certain behind the scenes things that I absolutely would tweak on the day. The first few turns of the resource system, basically, Carolina Kenny and Jerry had to just spin up an entire resource distribution system because the one I had prepared was crap. So they basically just had to completely adjust what I had, idiot that I am, had written. A thousand things like that. However, fundamentally, particularly, you know, afterwards in the pub afterwards and reading some of the after action reports and talking to people, you know, I really think what I managed to do was open up a creative space for players to let their imaginations go wild and to sort of really just walk into this magical world and say, hey, like, you know, this is a world with magic, this is a world with goddesses, this is a world with demons and vampires and all those wonderful things that we love. You know, what can I do? What is the mark I can make on this world? And I think the fact that I did manage to open up that possibility space for the players, I think fundamentally means the game overall was a success. And that, I think, is great and wonderful.
And I would absolutely say it was. Any last words from Eunice?
No, I would agree with that entirely. I think particularly from the perspective of the Gods game, once we kind of did away with some of the mechanics that weren't really working and went more to kind of wizard weezers and making stuff up, I had a much better time. And actually, not that I was having a terrible time before, but it definitely freed me up to do things like starting to send visions to the church people because I felt like Winter was pulling too far ahead and, you know, really putting the fear of me in them. And I think it definitely was a lot of fun, and obviously my cultists were superb, and I got so close to my ultimate objective, I think. And actually I wanted to ask Seamus, did you foresee that actually being a possibility, and how do you feel about the way that the game ended?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was always the chance that one of the goddesses going in, I actually thought Winter was the more likely goddess to be freed. But it ended up the summer cultist pulled a blinder and got you on the field. But no, there is always the possibility that the world would end. And indeed, you know, for those people who weren't there, the game ended with the Empress of Solaire riding in an all or nothing death or glory charge on her unicorn with her full magical arsenal, challenging the goddess Summer, Nice, to an all or nothing challenge, in which the goddess rolled 8d8 dices and the empress only rolled 5d6, and the empress won. I think it's safe to say that I stacked the odds in your favor, Nice. And yet, the mortals prevail overall.
For now. Although I have to say, if I got to do it again, I would not be giving out any damn unicorns. That's for sure.
Absolutely. No, I mean, yeah. I mean, overall, you know, I think people really got into it. I think there were these wonderful moments of high fantasy, you know, classic D&D, B-movie kind of moments, which I think which worked really well. And
on a personal level, it was disappointing, obviously, to be vanquished in the last moment and to have rolled so very, very poorly. But I felt like narratively, maybe it was a better thing for the mortal players and for the whole game that I was vanquished and didn't manage to burn everything. Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the finale of the movie, you know, the heroes do normally win and the world is normally saved. And, you know, I think that is, you know, that
I know,
is always
and I
fun.
I should have won as the hero.
Well, we'll leave it up to the listeners to see who is the, decide who is the hero there. But thank you very much, Seamus and Nice, for coming on.
I mean, Matthew, just before I go, I mean, there are so many people that helped make the game happen. Rob Grayson, who helped out, all the various control players, and indeed my mum. I want to have a special thank you to my dear old mum, who helped me cut out every single resource card, every single item, and every single spell card the week before the game. You want to talk about naivety and better planning and learning from your mistakes? Yeah, that's a big one right there. Forward planning. But anyway, my dear old mum, who gets a special thank you for doing that, and who ended up playing, by the way, who ended up playing the creator overall and trying to discipline her naughty goddess daughters. Anyway, but yeah, there are so many people who made the game happen, and they all deserve to live in a happy world with temperate weather.
Well, that is something that we live in the UK, so, you know, more or less temperate. Okie dokie. So, yeah, thanks very much for coming on, Beth. As ever, this has been the My Game Assembly interview podcast. We'll next week, I think we've got a blog post out for you, and then we'll have more podcasts coming. Please hop along to the site to see the blogs, the podcasts, the resources that we've got up there, including free made games and the calendar. So if you're interested in going along to a game, a calendar, all the games in the world that we know about. And if you've got anything you want to add on, please let us know. Also pop along to the True North Facebook page and website so you can see the games that they've got coming up later in the year as well. So thanks very much, Seamus. Thanks very much, Niece.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Brilliant. And we will talk to you all soon. Thanks very much. Bye, everyone.
Bye.